This is Focus 580, our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Good morning and welcome back to the show. In this part of the show, we will look back to the confirmation hearings for Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. Our guest this morning is Tim Phelps. He is a Supreme Court reporter for Newsday, and he is the reporter who broke the story of the allegations of sexual harassment against Judge Thomas by Anita Hill. He now has co-authored a book going back over this history. The book is entitled Capital Games, subtitled Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill, and the Story of a Supreme Court Nomination. It is out now. It's published by Hyperion, if you would like to read it. Our guest is a veteran journalist. He's written for a number of publications, including the New York Times, Baltimore Sun, and Providence Journal. And he is joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, you certainly should feel free to pick up the telephone and call. Our number here, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. So if it would be a long-distance call for you, you can use that toll-free line, that 800-222-9455. And folks here in Champaign-Urbana use the first number. That's 333-9455. And again, all we ask is for people to be brief with your questions and comments. That way we can accommodate more callers. Mr. Phelps, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thank you very much for joining us today.
I'm happy to be with you.
One of the things that Republicans in the Senate and the administration said about Anita Hill's charges was that it was an 11th hour effort to derail the nomination of Judge Thomas, and that when they couldn't find any other way to do it, this was something that they concocted, special interests who opposed the judge concocted and sprung at the last minute. And it is true that I think the first time this story became public was when the first story ran in Newsday, which was in October, I think.
October 6th, 1991.
And that the hearings, in fact, had begun September 10th. So
that's
this was
right.
Already after hearings had been underway for a while. But I guess the point I'm interested in starting at is that there were rumors circulating about Anita Hill, about the fact that she might have some things to say about Judge Thomas. A long time before this, back I think as early perhaps as July.
That's right.
When was the first time that you heard any mention of Anita Hill and the fact that she might have something to say about what had happened when she had been working for Judge Thomas?
Well, I first heard the rumor about Anita Hill around the end of July, 3 or 4 weeks after Thomas was nominated. And I know that's got to be surprising to people out there who as you said, think of this as a last-minute thing. But it was kicking around Washington for more than 2 months before these charges actually became known to the public.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about what the chronology was about how this information came to the attention of the mm-hmm. Judiciary Committee?
Well, it first came to the attention of a group called the Alliance for Justice, a liberal opposition group to Thomas. In July, a former classmate of Anita Hill's at Yale Law School told them about this. They passed the information on, and this is the critical thing. They passed the information on to the staffs of Senator Kennedy and Senator Metzenbaum around the end of July or early August. And had they acted on the information then, it wouldn't have seemed like a last-minute assassination attempt. It would have come out with a lot more research and in time for a proper consideration of the information to take place.
Mm-hmm.
Anita, they finally did do something a month later in early September, and Anita Hill told her story to a staffer for Senator Metzenbaum virtually the same day that the first set of hearings on Clarence Thomas were beginning in the Judiciary Committee on September 10th. And so even at that point, it was still would have been possible, had the information been taken seriously, to do something with it.
And I suppose that one of the the intriguing questions about this is why it is that no one who had heard about it, that is in the Senate, Republicans or Democrats, thought that it was serious enough to merit more investigation or their attention. And, you know, again, one may talk about this being a Democratic effort to get Judge Thomas. But the fact is, if there were Democrats who wanted to do that, that information was there and it was available.
Right.
And yet they didn't. It seemed like nobody wanted to touch it.
That's exactly right. There's several reasons for that. One of them is that sexual harassment just wasn't considered to be a big deal at that point, even by the Democrats. I first learned that the Judiciary Committee was onto this story later in September, after the FBI had gotten involved. And a member of the Judiciary Committee said, it's just some two-bit sexual harassment charge. Everybody in the Senate thinks today that sexual harassment is a very important problem. They didn't then. The other problem is that so many of the senators had their own personal ethical problems, whether it was financial involving the savings and loan scandal or personal, such as Senator Kennedy's problems in Palm Beach. We really found in talking to people for this book that the Senate as an institution had really been crippled, incapacitated by the ethical problems of its own members, which resulted in an inability of the institution to really consider the moral qualifications of any nominee.
And it seemed that once the story became public, then the Senate had very few options. In a sense, they perhaps could have handled it better and differently if they had done something about it before that point.
Absolutely.
But once the story came out,
I'm really convinced, and people at the staff level in the Senate are convinced that the whole thing would have come out differently if it had been handled earlier. I mean, people have had every right to question the motivation of information that came out 3 days before the Senate was to vote at the end of a 3.5-month process.
One thing that perhaps people tend to forget or don't think about, and you certainly talk about it as you lay out the record of how Judge Thomas's now Justice Thomas's nomination was received, and then how the hearings went up to the point that Anita Hill, that became the issue, that there was opposition to his nomination, certainly from people who were pro-choice, but also people in labor, people in senior citizens groups, the NAACP, the Congressional Black Caucus, even the American Bar Association, which is not particularly known as a liberal bastion, had some questions about his qualifications to be a member of the court, which all raises the question that if the whole Anita Hill thing hadn't come along, if all the senators were voting on was simply Judge Thomas's record, what he had said in the hearings, what he had written, his qualifications, would he have been confirmed?
Oh, yes. He would have been fairly easily confirmed. The vote probably would have been 60-40 in his favor or better than that. And this was even though the senators had begun to figure out that Thomas was a lot more conservative than the man presented to them by the White House. But the reason he would have been confirmed is basically because he was black, and the Democrats did not feel comfortable in challenging the qualifications for this job of an African American who belongs to a constituency that's very important to many senators.
Hmm. What sort of discussions were there? What sort of things did people have to say when the news first broke that he was the choice of the Bush administration? Did people talk about his record? Were there people who said, a lot of people who said he'll make a great justice? Were there a lot of people who said he wasn't qualified to be a justice?
Well, I think there was a lot of confusion. Clarence Thomas was something out of the ordinary in the American political world. He was, as the White House emphasized, he was a black man who'd grown up in poverty and racism in the South, who was a conservative who espoused all of the conservative ideals, including on a philosophy against affirmative action and quotas that the Republican conservatives stood for. So really most of the early debate was focused around this seeming enigma, although I think that Clarence Thomas is right in saying that is at best a limited and at worst racism to think that the blacks have to have a particular political point of view.
We're talking this morning with Tim Phelps. He is the Supreme Court reporter for Newsday, covered the confirmation hearings for Clarence Thomas, and was the reporter who broke the Anita Hill story. And he's written about it in a book which he has co-authored. The book is entitled Capital Games, and it is out now if you would like to read it. We have several people here who would like to talk with you. If you have questions, comments, they are welcome. But again, we just ask you to be brief, stay on point. That way we can accommodate more callers. We'll start in here with a caller on our toll-free line. Hello.
David, I have a challenge of your fairness on this Hill-Thomas issue, because this is a situation in which the establishment press has deliberately, knowingly excluded important facts. There was a conservative magazine, the American Spectator, did an excellent investigative report on these excluded facts. A good report. I can't remember the guy's name. As a matter of fact, I only heard about the article. I have to admit, I did not myself read the article. But you could have included someone such as the author, that investigative reporter. Have you offered any of those people time on your air?
Well, maybe I could ask you what excluded facts are you talking about, and we'll at least we can give our guest today a chance to respond to that.
Okay. Now, there are several. One of them is that investigating the testimony given by Anita Hill's feminist friends, you know, that before the Senate committee, that testimony about the fact that Anita Hill had actually complained of sexual harassment. Remember now, if you remember back, the question was, Ms. Hill, if you're a lawyer and you were being sexually harassed by Clarence Thomas, why didn't you report it? And so she had several friends that came forward and said, well, she had complained to these friends about sexual harassment. But it turns out on further investigation that the friends that those conversations in which she complained about sexual harassment had occurred before she even knew Clarence Thomas. Couldn't possibly have been Clarence Thomas. She never named Clarence Thomas, but Clarence Thomas could not possibly have been the culprit because the conversations occurred before she even knew Clarence Thomas.
Okay, let's do them one at a time, because I want to see what Mr. Phelps has.
Sure.
Can you shed any light on that?
Yes, we go into this a little bit in the book. One of the four witnesses who said that she had told them of this alleged harassment, Judge Hockner from California, actually gave a date initially that could not have been accurate. She said that Hill had told her of this alleged harassment before Hill had actually gone to work for Thomas at the Department of Education. That's not the case with the other three witnesses, and Judge Hockner said later before the committee that she had gotten the date wrong. 10 years later, she'd made a mistake, and the Republicans at the time seemed to accept that.
Well, let's go on, and what are the other points?
Yeah, Senator Spector caught Anita Hill in a case of perjury, and it's been so long ago, I can't remember, perhaps Mr. Phelps can help me, the actual issue upon which she is alleged to have perjured herself. I don't remember the actual issue. But I do remember that when Senator Spector, knowing the situation and detecting when she initially answered his question, that she was lying. He knew that. And so, like a good prosecutor, he restated the question repeatedly, you know, so that Professor Hill would repeat the lie and eliminate any chance that she should claim that she had misspoken or just been misunderstood. Now, that perjured testimony occurred before the lunch hour. During the lunch hour, as I understand the situation, my memory is not totally clear on this, but as I remember, Senator Spector got further documentation to demonstrate that she had lied, and at the same time, Anita Hill and her friends were scurrying around trying to get support for her perjured testimony. As I understand the situation, Anita Hill's friends would not agree to perjure themselves in order to support her. And so when she came back and the testimony reopened after lunch, she, after long conferences with her attorney, in questioning by Senator Spector is questioning her again after lunch, she delivered one of these rambling, kind of a babble, if you had only understood what I meant, kind of an explanation to Senator Spector. Anyone listening to that rambling testimony couldn't make heads and tails out of it, except that every once in a while she said, if you had only understood what I meant. Well, you know, the press jumped on I think Senator Spector did a wonderful job of getting to the real facts, but the press defended Professor Hill and attacked Spector on the matter.
Mr. Phelps, you do remember you go into some detail about this whole question about whether or not there was, in fact, an incidence of perjury.
Well, yes, and the legal experts we talked to said that this was the most ridiculous allegation they heard in the whole 3 days, that legally speaking, there wasn't any, by any stretch of the imagination, anything that might remotely consist of perjury. Hill was questioned by Spector about whether or not she had been told that Thomas might withdraw if these charges were brought forward, and they went round and round and round as to in a semantic argument over that issue, and there is absolutely no evidence that I've seen anywhere that she asked anybody to perjure themselves in testimony that this had occurred. That's a totally new idea as far as I can see. It is true that Hill did in the afternoon come back and clarify her statement of her own initiative and volition, and I don't recall any additional evidence brought forward by Spector. But as a legal matter, this wasn't perjury by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, Senator Spector is an experienced prosecutor. I am not a lawyer, but there are several people. And by the way, the American Spectator article backs him up in this, I understand. And so, in other words, there can be a considerable case made for perjury. Senator Spector said it was no doubt in his mind that it was perjury. Let me just bring up just one final thing because I'm taking too long. But we have an unlimited budget for special prosecutors to prosecute things like Iran-Contra. But when the investigation on the deliberate publication of felonious libels, now you know that these were leaked, and Mr. Phelps, you were one of the recipients of felonious leaks. The leaks out of the Senate like this are felonies. They were based on raw FBI files that were total allegations. We have laws protecting the indictment, you know, grand jury laws. Our entire grand jury system is to prevent this kind of libel from getting into the public arena. And the Senate somehow, they could authorize an unlimited budget for a special prosecutor to prosecute Iran-Contra. But when they were investigating their own people to find out who leaked this felonious information to you, somehow they couldn't investigate telephone records, because that would be impolite. I'm just going to hang up and let you.
Okay. Well, I definitely want to hear what Mr. Phelps has to say, because of course all of these events involve you very closely.
Yes. Well, I mean, the amazing thing from my point of view is that the Senate didn't investigate who was telling the truth in this matter. I mean, either we have an unprecedented and incredibly illegal conspiracy to commit perjury before the U.S. Senate to keep a Supreme Court justice off the court for political reasons, or we have a sitting Supreme Court justice who has committed perjury to get on the court. And it seems to me that is the matter that ought to be investigated. As to that article your caller and many others like to hold up as evidence of the truth in this matter, I found myself that most of the information in that article, at least that I know about personally, was highly inaccurate. I'll give you an example. It speculated that my source and Nina Totenberg's source for the information was a man who had said was close friends with both of us and was a staffer for Senator Metzenbaum. But this was a man I had not only never met and never talked to, but never heard of before. Yet the article said flat out that this was the source. That was the level of reporting that I found in that article. Yet people all over the country seem to want to grasp onto it as some sort of evidence that Anita Hill was lying. It's an amazing phenomenon.
Again, our guest this morning is Tim Phelps. He's Supreme Court reporter with Newsday and is the co-author of a book, Capital Games, which is about the nomination to the Supreme Court of Clarence Thomas. And if you have questions, you can give us a call. Our lines are full. We do want to accommodate as many people as we can. So, again, I'll have to try to ask the callers to be brief if that is possible. And we'll go on. Line one is next. Hello.
Hello. Excuse me, but I'm not stupid enough to believe that Senator Simon and Senator Metzenbaum didn't recognize the dynamite of a sexual harassment charge against Clarence Thomas. What's more likely is they recognized that it wouldn't withstand a more sober analysis during the regular committee process. And what they did was, They just decided to blow the issue on national TV the Saturday, the weekend before he was going to be voted either confirmed or denied for his Supreme Court positions. And they figured, well, this story's bogus. There's nothing but allegations to it, but it won't matter if we make a big news story out of it, because it'll destroy Clarence Thomas, and it'll bring public opinion against him, and it'll defeat him that way. So what do you say to that?
Well, it's just not what happened.
I mean, yes, it is what happened. I saw it.
Would you like to give the guest a chance to respond, please? Go ahead, Mr. Phelps.
I was intimately involved in this process on the inside, and I well understand the feeling of outrage at the fact that this material was used when it was, but I can tell you from having been there that the motivation was more political cowardice than the kind of bravado that your caller is suggesting.
Well, can I say something?
Senator Metzenbaum got a full report of Anita Hill's allegations on September 10th, and instead of pursuing the matter himself, he ordered her staff to hand it over to the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, Senator Biden, which was the procedure that he was supposed to carry out. But Chairman Biden did absolutely nothing with this information for several weeks.
Earlier in your comments, you said that, for example, Senator Biden, Senator Simon, Senator Metzenbaum, senators in general, didn't bring this up in the regular committee process because, to quote you, they didn't think sexual harassment was a big deal. That's what you said in your introductory remarks during your interview with the show host.
Mm-hmm.
Now, who's going to believe that? Nobody. There's no way Senator Simon and Senator Metzenbaum are going to have that opinion. Oh, well, we're not going to bring this up because sexual harassment's not a big deal. There's no way. They were searching for a way to destroy Thomas. The reason they didn't bring it up during the regular committee process is because it's either a bogus charge or there's nothing but an allegation there. And the way it was leaked was, to quote Senator Hatch, a little too cute to be true. And anybody who would believe what you're trying to tell us, I mean, they'll believe anything. Anybody who can believe what you're saying, they're capable of believing anything.
Well, the only thing that I can say about that is that it's amazing how both sides on this issue are absolutely convinced that they're right. The people who believe Hill just can't imagine that Thomas was telling the truth. The people who believe Thomas want to believe every possible conspiracy regarding Anita Hill. I have tried here to go back and put on the record what happened so that to the extent that I know, and I don't know who was telling the truth, but I have tried to put the background on the record to help people have a more informed opinion with which to make up their minds. But nobody really wants to talk about it. They simply want to assert their own views on one side or the other of what must have happened rather than what did happen.
Let's go on, if the caller will indulge me. I have several other people waiting, so we'll go next to line number 3. Hello.
Yes, I guess there's room for all kinds of opinions on here. I couldn't disagree more with the two people who just finished up. I suggest that they and other people might read, in addition to the guest book, which I have not yet read, but I will, the book by Senator Paul Simon entitled Advice and Consent, which gives his side of the story. Whether you agree with it or not, at least it's interesting to read. And according to him, the reason they didn't bring this up in regular committee meeting was because the accuser declined to be identified. And it wasn't until the weekend, and he was in Kansas, he got a call saying that this person Anita Hill, had decided to identify and make the accusation. But I also have a question for the guest. He said that Thomas would have been confirmed anyhow before the Anita Hill business came up. Isn't it true that in the committee, first vote of the committee, it was 7-7?
Yes, that's right, and that was quite a surprise. It had been expected that the Senate Judiciary Committee would approve Justice Thomas fairly easily, but because several of the senators thought he was not being straight with them about his political and judicial beliefs, it ended up coming out of committee with only a 7-7 tie and no recommendation. Nevertheless, the head count on the floor of the Senate were somewhat different considerations are at play showed at least 60 senators in favor of Thomas at that point.
I listened to most of the hearing, the Anita Hill end before that, and I was amazed that 7 members of that committee could vote to confirm him on the basis of his evasiveness about various questions. And for a lawyer and a judge to say he'd never thought about Roe versus Wade is just inconceivable. But in regard to the leaks, the man talking about felonious leaks, all I can say is thank God for the leaks.
Well, thank you. We found in talking to people about the Roe v. Wade question that we found one conservative backer of Thomas's in Washington who told us that he thought that Thomas had taken a position in conversation with him and his group against Roe v. Wade or against abortion. So the issue of credibility was really what brought Clarence Thomas down to that 7-7 tie in the first place, even before Anita Hill's allegations had come forward.
Hmm. Again, I thank the caller. Let's go on to someone else, and that's line number two.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm calling really to question the veracity of our inspector. I lived across the street. This was 20 years ago. I lived across the street from him for 5 years. And his son pushed my son in front of a bicycle. And both the son and Mr. Spector denied that this happened. My son lost his spleen as a result of this accident. And we sued Mr. Spector. He was a district attorney in Philadelphia at that time. And we won. So I question his veracity in the way he questioned everybody and the way he ran the show.
Well, of course, as you know, Senator Spector is facing a very tough race in Pennsylvania based largely on his performance before the Judiciary Committee. He has an opponent named Lynn Yankel who got into the race after watching that performance.
Yes, I'm aware of that, and I wish her all the success in the world. I do not like Mr. Spector.
All right. Well, I thank you for the call.
Thank you.
That's interesting. I hadn't heard that story.
One of the interesting points to speculate on is what sort of reverberations down time this whole business is going to have. One likely outcome will be that we're going to have more women in the Senate than we have ever had before. Past that, it's, I suppose, a little difficult to speculate. I wonder what you think about what this, you know, may mean over the long run of things for both Mr. Thomas and Ms. Hill, and also for the country in general.
Well, I think that this whole affair has had a much bigger impact than simply one vote on the Supreme Court, as important as that is. As you say, it's clear that both the Senate and the House are going to have large numbers of women elected this year, largely because of what is known as the Anita Hill effect, despite the fact that a majority of the American people and a majority of the American women said at the time in polls that they believed Clarence Thomas, not Hill. Despite that, those women who believed Hill were so mad that they got out and got involved in the political process. They gave money to women candidates. They started working for women candidates. And it has really meant the resurgence of a kind of moderate feminism, not really feminism in the 60s sense, but just women getting into political office that is really changing the political course in this country, and may well, if Governor Clinton is elected, it may be the margin of victory by which he gets in.
Mm-hmm. Another caller here, our toll-free line again. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I'm awfully glad to get on because I thought those first men that were going to speak were, I thought what you should first say is, do you believe your president? He thought Anita Hill was lying. And or are you Republican or something of that nature? Because, you know, they were talking about they didn't believe in sexual harassment. And I agree with this man. This is changing the political scene. My husband was furious. I was furious when we watched this. And by the way, wasn't there another woman that had experienced sexual harassment and they did not bring her on? And also, wasn't he known in college as the pornography king? And these things were all in the New York Times. We never saw them back here in the Midwest. Is this correct?
Well, some of it was in the New York Times, and some of it wasn't. There was another woman, and this is very important, a woman named Angela Wright, a newspaper editor in North Carolina, who had come to Washington and was prepared to testify that she, too, had been sexually harassed by Clarence Thomas. She was never called by the committee.
You see, I find this so bad because a sexual harassment person is always there and he's always on and ready to go. And it's like Phyllis Schlafly said, oh, I've never been sexually harassed. You know, there are liars out there and there are men out there that refuse to believe that this happens. And it happens.
I think that if Angela Wright had been called, if there had been that kind of testimony, it would have made a big difference. She wasn't called, we found, because the Republicans on the Judiciary Committee had basically tricked the Democrats into thinking that they had some damaging information on Wright that as far as we could find, just did not exist.
Well, thank you very much for being on.
All right. Thank you for the call. It was also true, I think, that those people who were there helping Anita Hill and advising her, they had more people who were willing to come on and testify to her character. They had some more character witnesses, but they made a decision at some point not to present those people, so that there was there were many more people speaking for Judge Thomas than for Professor Hill. Do you think that might have made any difference?
I think it might have made some difference. I think the Hill legal team made a real mistake on Sunday, the third day of the hearings. They thought that, rather incredibly now looking back on it, they thought that they had won, that Anita Hill had taken and passed a polygraph test, that they had put on this panel of four witnesses saying she had told them about sexual harassment. And they were nervous about their own panel, about the kinds of allegations that the Republicans might make and against these people. And they didn't want to put Anita Hill's friends through the same kind of a personal inquisition that Anita Hill had gone through.
We have about 10 minutes left. Our guest is Tim Phelps. He's Supreme Court reporter with Newsday, and we're talking about the nomination hearings for Clarence Thomas, the allegations of sexual harassment against him by Anita Hill, all of that recorded in the book which he co-authored, Capital Games, published by Hyperion, if you would like to look at it. We do have several callers, and we'll, again, try to include as many people as we can in our last 10 minutes here. We'll go next to line one. Hello.
Good morning. I have a request for some information. Are you knowledgeable about the childhood years of both Justice Thomas and Attorney Hill?
Yes, we included fairly extensive biographies of both people in our book.
The general perception that I've gleaned from the media presentations is that both of them came from what used to be called very humble beginnings, and their parents and local relatives had a long row to hoe and the typical earlier American difficult struggle in raising a family and children. Is that accurate?
Well, it's accurate to a point. It's very true that both of them came from difficult struggling kinds of backgrounds, but we found in fact that the backgrounds were after that very, very different. Hill came from a very strong family of 13 children, where half the kids in her class, including herself, were valedictorians at the local high school, a very close, tight family. Whereas, of course, Clarence Thomas didn't have that advantage. He came from a broken home. He was basically abandoned first by his father and then given up by his mother to a grandfather who was at first very reluctant to take him, and therefore had a much less happy family beginning.
Okay. Do you remember what year each of these got out of high school?
Not off the top of my head. I would think that Clarence Thomas must have gotten out of high school in roughly 1966, and Hill in a 4 or 5 years later.
So then that would mean both of these people grew up in the days when there weren't a lot of programs going around to so-called solve all these problems.
That's right.
So I think, David, this amazingly coincides with the previous hour. Throwing money at it is not the answer. And thank you. You confirmed what I had thought that I was gleaning from previous media reports, and that is that both of these people came up like what used to be called the old-fashioned way. They obviously... Well, let me ask it as a question. Are you able to figure out what it was that it saved Clarence Thomas?
Well, several things. One was the fact that his grandfather was a real tough guy and made him go forward on his own. But I think you're about to embrace a misconception. Clarence Thomas got into college, that's Holy Cross University in Worcester, Mass., and into law school, Yale Law School, because of a new wave of affirmative action programs. So he did very much benefit from affirmative action, and I think has always, in fact, he said he's always felt conflicted by that because he it made him feel uncomfortable. It made him feel like he hadn't accomplished things on his own.
Let us go on again. Line two is next. Hello.
Morning, David.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to see if your guest has any comments about Ted Kennedy's performance on the Judiciary Committee. And I'll start there.
Okay.
Sure. Well, we devote quite a bit in the book to Senator Kennedy. Senator Kennedy's defenders have always said, well, his personal life is unfortunate. But he's always been very effective in the Senate, and indeed in the past he had been. But this is really the first instance where it was clear that Senator Kennedy's personal problems had affected his performance in the Senate. In fact, it virtually incapacitated him from pursuing the Hill question in the first place, and secondly, from performing the role he would have performed had he not been under this cloud when Anita Hill came before the committee.
David, does your guest have a guess for us as to who did leak the information or be willing to share with us?
Well, I mean, obviously, I have to protect my sources. I spent 4 months fighting off the Senate. And ultimately winning a decision from the Senate that the First Amendment did protect my sources, I would like to assert that this was not a leak in the sense that most people think of it. I wasn't just walking down some Senate corridor when somebody said, "Psst, Phelps, take this." It was a story that I worked on for months and had many sources on, not just one.
Okay, well, I thank you for your hard work.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Again, we'll go on and get at least one more caller here. Line three is next.
I'll try to be as brief as I can be.
Okay.
I wanted to underscore and bring out a point a little more strongly that he made earlier on, which I didn't feel was emphasized enough. I listened very carefully to both testimonies and listened to the trial very carefully, or the trial. Again, it seemed like such a trial. Anyway, the thing that... I don't know that the truth was brought out, and I don't know if anyone ever will know what the truth was, but I was flabbergasted at the aftermath of the hearings when the people who had been saying this has been a terrible conspiracy to thwart the nomination, this has been a concoction by the Democrats and liberals to thwart this nomination, and therefore we need a very strong Senate investigation as to who leaked it, not who concocted it. This would be a terrible travesty if this were true, that this has been a conspiracy of the people within the Senate hearing committee and the Senate in general to bring these perjured witnesses forward to that cause this whole investigation, which was a ridiculous circus. But if somebody decided they wanted to do this and fabricated all this, I want to know who it was, what they're still doing in the Senate, and what so forth. But no one cares. No one seems to think it means that there's any cause for investigation to find out what the real truth is. And that in itself, to me, tells me that the people who are charging conspiracy, knew that it was not a conspiracy, and that the allegations, whether true or not, were given in the spirit of truth. Thank you very much. I'll listen.
Well, I don't know what to add to that. I certainly agree with that sentiment. I think it's outrageous that no official is investigating what really happened here. And it seems to me both sides have it have a terrific interest in seeing the truth come to light, and that it's unfortunate, as I said before, that so many people have decided that they know the truth when there just is no proof one way or the other.
One of the things that I think strikes me in going back through and reading the account and trying to get at least some idea of what happened behind the scenes is that as we know, that there are people who believe that this was a deliberate effort either by Democrats on the Hill or by groups on the left in this country to destroy Judge Thomas and sabotage his nomination, that it was organized and orchestrated. If that's the case, this was one of the most poorly organized plots in the history of the country, because in fact it was the supporters, I think, of Judge Thomas that were far more organized and skillful in their managing of this case than those people who were his critics.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, after all, the other side, the Republicans and the White House knew that this allegation was out there. I mean, Thomas and Hill had been interviewed by the FBI, and Friday night before my story came out, they decided that they'd made it through, that nobody would report it on the weekend, and went out and had a party in celebration. So, I mean, both sides knew about this all this time, and for a variety of reasons, as we've discussed, nothing was done about it sooner.
Were you at one time concerned that that you might have to go to jail rather than reveal your sources?
Well, I was prepared to do that if necessary. I never really thought that the U.S. Senate would have such low regard for the First Amendment that they would put a reporter in jail.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that because we're here at the end of the time. I want to thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much, David, for having me.
Our guest, Timothy Phelps, is a Supreme Court reporter with Newsday. And if you would like to read his account of this story, one which he co-authored with Helen Winternitz, you can read the book. It's entitled Capital Games. It is out now in the bookstores. Hyperion is the publisher.